Hey, VBackLink family, it's Lily, and I was wondering if I could ask you a really quick favor. If the VBackLink has ever helped you, encouraged you, or taught you something along your birth after cesarean journey, I would be so grateful if you would vote for us for Best Podcast in NoCo Style's Best of NoCo Awards. As a Northern Colorado born and raised mama myself, this is especially meaningful for me. It takes less than a minute to vote, and we've linked it right in the show notes. Every vote helps more families discover the VBackLink, bringing more awareness to VBack education and support. Thank you so much for cheering on our little team. We appreciate you more than you know. So go to the show notes, click the link to vote, and then come back to this episode for another incredible episode.
Hello, hello. You are listening to the VBackLink podcast. I am your host today, Paige, joined by Lily. Hello, Lily.
Hello. Happy Cesarean Awareness Month.
Right? To some, and however you feel about Cesarean Awareness Month is totally valid. To some, Cesarean Awareness Month is icky and sticky. Oh, and by the way, we have Jack back here. So he's, I don't
Mom
know.
Life.
But we can, so if you hear some little things shifting around, that's a baby in the background. But yes, Cesarean Awareness Month can be invalidating. We hope that from our end, you feel that it is validating. And I know for me, it can be a little bit complex. Lily, how do you feel about Cesarean Awareness Month in general?
I think when I first had a C-section, I felt kind of frustrated that it had to exist. You know, like kind of mad. Like, why do I have to I'm also a lost mom. I think I've talked about this before. I've lost two babies in an ectopic and miscarriage. And there's also like ectopic awareness month and miscarriage awareness month. And I remember just being like, why do I have to be part of another like awareness thing that, you know, something I went through was hard enough that it like needs awareness brought to it, you know? But now I see it just as a chance to like uplift and honor in many ways, like where we've come from and like hold space for stories that sometimes are dismissed or not often told well, like as a like empowerment or as a like holding space for grief. And so I see it a little differently now, I think on years down the road from a C-section, but yeah. How about you?
Same. Yeah, exactly. It's like, well, I don't need Cesarean Awareness Month because I am very aware that I had this. And anyway, I agree with you that it's about the nuance, and we hope to bring to you that nuance. This month will be full of stories. We wanted to hit on reasons why cesareans happen most often. And for those searching for a VBAC, we wanted to have stories of VBACs happening with a lot of these things that could turn into cesareans. So today we have Katie on the podcast. She is from Oregon. She is a midwife also. She's had two out-of-hospital VBACs and one with a big, big baby. A big baby and shoulder dystocia.
I think we should leave it. Like, drum roll. Wait for how big this baby was, women of strength. It's our jaws were on the floor. So
she was record setting at her birth center.
Yeah.
So yeah, and also, like, we don't want to forget about our CBAC and repeat cesarean moms either. So we have an amazing episode that you will want to watch for coming up, all about maternal assisted cesareans, which is my love. So
yes.
Anyway, yeah. Lily. So
it's going to be a good month. It's going to be a good month.
Yes.
Okay. Well, before we get into it, I have a review of the week that just came in 4 days ago, which is so exciting. And this is just your reminder, women of strength, if you want for us to hear from you. This is like such a sweet way to get to hear from you as our listeners, as those who can give us feedback. And just, we love hearing your stories in this way. So I'm going to read this one and then we'll get into some other stuff. So, okay. It says informative and inspiring. Oh, who is it by? It is by Hungry 2469. So great. It says, informative and inspiring. I knew I would come back and leave a positive review no matter the outcome of my second birth, but sharing the news of a successful VBAC in my review was something I visualized and I am thrilled to include. I first found the VBAC link via a blog you posted as I laid in my recovery room post C-section back in 2024. From there, I found the podcast and the course, and the combination of VBAC stories on the podcast and the videos and readings from the course prepared and inspired me to achieve my VBAC 2 days ago. So she's like 6 days postpartum. Oh my gosh. Thank you from the bottom of my heart for connecting women to important information that is truly life-changing. When I got home from the hospital yesterday and was able to get my 22-month-old up from his nap myself with cuddles, I couldn't help but think of this organization for making this possible. I received my dream of vaginal birth, and I am able to pour out all of my love emotionally and physically into my two children. Oh.
Oh, congratulations. VBACs matter for these reasons. That's why we do this. That's why we're here. So that you can bend over and pick up your babies and snuggle them and have a better postpartum and just feel great about your birth. So anyway, thank you for leaving that review.
So good. Well, Women of Strength, you can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify. You can comment on Spotify on our episodes. We're putting these on YouTube, so you can leave a comment on YouTube as well. If you're watching us there, hey. And we're going to get into Katie's story. You won't want to miss it. Let's do it. Hi, I'm Lily.
And I'm Paige. Welcome to the VBAC Link podcast.
We're moms and doulas who know firsthand that birth after cesarean isn't always straightforward. I'm a miscarriage and ectopic mom who went on to have a hospital water birth VBAC.
And I've had two CBACs and a planned maternal assisted cesarean.
Our experiences may be different, but our mission is the same: to make birth after cesarean better.
On this podcast, you'll hear powerful stories of VBACs, repeat cesareans, and CBACs from women around the world.
We'll also bring in expert insight, practical tools, and encouragement to help you feel informed and supported as you plan your next birth.
Whether you're preparing for a VBAC, choosing a repeat cesarean, or simply exploring your options, this space is for you.
Because every story matters, and we're here to remind you that you've got options, you've got support, and you're never alone.
The VBAC Link is storytelling by nature. The stories on this podcast do not represent a universally best or safest option for everyone.
This podcast is intended to encourage and inform. It does not replace individualized advice from a qualified medical provider.
Welcome back. We have Katie with us. We are so excited to hear your stories. I will read a little bit about her, and then Katie, we will turn the time over to you. Katie is a mother of three and a midwife. She has had two successful out-of-hospital VBACs. Her first two births led her to birth work and midwifery. She's passionate about sharing her story and education around out-of-hospital births and VBAC. Okay, so let's hear it, Katie. Yay, welcome.
All right, so, you know, we're all here because of a C-section, right? So it started with my first pregnancy. And I had done some research, a little bit of research in the beginning in our area, the hospitals here. There's one, we're in a smaller area. So we have one large hospital and a couple smaller ones. One of the smaller ones is known for doing like water births, more personal care. And so I ended up transferring to that hospital and I just picked a doctor that would deliver there. I didn't really know much. And I had a great pregnancy, no complications. And I went into spontaneous labor on my own, which very excited for a first-time mom at 40 and 2. I guess I should back up a little bit. This was in 2020. She was born May 5th of 2020, and I remember the last few appointments I had with my OB. It was always like, what's new today? What's the restrictions today? And it was always like, first it was nothing. Everything's fine. Everything's great. And then it was, you can't have anybody outside your partner there. So I couldn't have my mom. And the next week was, you can't have a doula. This hospital specifically had a doula program. So I didn't hire one, but you could call one when you were in labor. And that's one thing I was really excited about. So no doula. Our childbirth class was canceled. Just my partner. First-time parents. And, you know, still excited, but a little bummed about all these things. And, you know, show up in labor and admitted at 4 centimeters. Everything's great. I wanted an unmedicated birth. And this hospital has these like really big, really nice tubs that you can actually give birth in. So I was really excited to use that. My husband did the best he could do, and he was great. And the nurse's staff was fabulous. I progressed really quick to like transition. And then I stalled out for a long time. And the doctor kind of had come back and was kind of like, well, let's try something. And I was like, okay, sure. And so they broke my water. And that didn't really do anything, didn't help much. And at that point, I was really tired. So of course they offered the epidural and I said, sign me up. I'm so tired. So I did. I had the epidural and I took a great nap and then I woke up and I was complete and I was like, yay, we're going to have a baby. And I pushed for probably 3 to 4 hours. And baby was still high up and I was just getting really tired. Her heart rate started raising with pushing and then coming back down. And then the doctor eventually was like, hey, we might want to consider having a C-section. I just burst into tears. This was my worst nightmare coming true. But I kind of felt like I didn't have a choice at that point. And so I agreed to the C-section. She said it wasn't an emergency. Baby was still okay, but this might be where it's headed. We had the C-section. Everything was great. She was perfect. She was 8 pounds, 10 ounces. And no real complications except for reacting poorly to the morphine and not being present for the first 12 hours or so and 4 or 5 days in the hospital. And again, no one's allowed to visit and everyone's wearing masks. And it just was a little stressful as a first-time parent. And we get home and I really struggled emotionally with that, even though I was like, well, we're healthy and everything went great and no complications on her part or my part. But I struggled with that and I said, I don't want to do that again, unless we have to. I really don't want to do that again. So I did a lot of research. And in our area, I live in Southern Oregon, and we have one out-of-hospital birth center. We have lots of home birth midwives, but my husband wasn't too into that at the time. And so I didn't even know this birth center existed before my first. And when we started talking about our second, we went and we interviewed with one of the midwives. I wasn't even pregnant yet. I just was like, I got to have all my ducks in a row. And I was like, this is it. I love it. It's great. And so a few months later, I ended up getting pregnant with our second. And both of these babies were very planned. And I had everything. I like to call it now in hindsight, like a textbook pregnancy VBAC situation. Being that out of hospital, I did have to have an MFM consult with our local MFM doctor. But other than that, there was no real extra. I had all the, you know, hour-long midwifery appointments, and I was really worried about positioning. I guess the reason for the C-section baby was sunny side up, so facing up, and so positioning was really hard, and so she just wasn't coming down, and so I was really worried about that in my second pregnancy. We talked a lot about that. I did some physical therapy for some, like, pelvic pain. But other than that, I didn't really do anything else. I was working. I had my toddler.
Did you interview any other? So you interviewed the birth center before you got pregnant. Did you interview anybody else?
Mm-mm.
Do you have any other thoughts? Okay.
No.
No.
No. And I think at the time I just was like, where we lived, I didn't really want a home birth. And my husband wasn't really interested. And so it was like this or the hospital type situation. I did get a doula the second time, who's very well known in our area. And yeah, we'll get to that point. She was great. So in pregnancy, I did choose to do a couple things differently, as you can choose. And some states allow this for out-of-hospital birth. So I didn't really do any of the testing. I mean, I did like blood work, but I didn't do gestational diabetes testing. I didn't do the Glucola drink. And we just checked on baby and everything like that. My first baby was a little larger on the larger side, 8 pounds, 10 ounces. I mean, it's not huge, but it's not tiny. And so I was expecting something around that range. I did have to have that consult with the MFM doctor. I was about 35 weeks when I had that. And baby's now measuring in the 92nd percentile. So he was big. And the doctor, I'll never forget, we're friends now because we work together. but I'll never forget, he told me at 35 weeks pregnant, that he said, if anything, because I'm birthing out of hospital, if anything happens, your baby's dead and you're next. And I'll never forget it. I burst into tears. And since then, I told him when I came back for this pregnancy, I was like, you know what he told me? And he was like, he's just a really like straightforward guy. He did apologize for making me cry. like I said, we're friends now, but I'll never forget that. And I was like, I don't even care. And you know, the VBAC calculator gave me a 32% chance. And I was like, whatever. It's going to happen. Like, I was just like really gung-ho about having a VBAC. And it's why I chose out of hospital, is I felt like I had the most chance of success with that type of support versus, like I said, we have a few local hospitals. Only one of them does VBACs. and it was a larger one, and I didn't want to go there. So I was like, there's just no other choice. This just has to happen. There was a couple conversations after that 35-week ultrasound of baby measuring large, like, did we miss gestational diabetes? And I was like, no, I don't think so. We did some like glucometer readings, blood sugar checks, and things like that. And everything looked good. And then at 40 and 2, again, I said, I'm all done being pregnant. And I decided to do the midwife's brew, which it a form of castor oil and some other goodies. And it worked. I went into labor after the second dose. We have this whole protocol to do it. And within an hour, contractions started. And that was around 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And he was born 11 hours later. So, like I said, I felt like it went really textbook. Things picked up really quick after I put my daughter to bed, of course. And then within an hour, I went from speaking to the midwives to no longer talking. And we decided to meet at the birth center about 9:30. And then I lived in the next town over. So it was about a 45-minute drive. And I was in transition. That was not very fun. But made it to the birth center, and my doula met us there, and she, because it took us a little bit longer to get there, she was like, I hope you weren't having a baby on the side of the road. Like, I did arrive at 9 centimeters, so I was like, yes, like this is so awesome and great. And I got to use the tub and just kind of like everything I wanted, waited for my body to start pushing, and you know, I had the doula there and the support of the midwives and my mom this time and my best friend, like, everything the last birth wasn't in the support department. I pushed in the tub because, you know, they don't care where you give birth. And I just didn't like it. So I ended up giving birth on my back on the bed, which is whatever worked. And I was fine with that. It did take an hour and a half to push. And so I was like, I don't like that. I wanted to take less time. I kind of considered it my first vaginal birth, though, kind of like a first baby situation, you know, that can take some time. And he was born, and it was amazing. I remember one of the first things I said was 32% my ass, Dr. Khan, which is Dr. Khan's the MFM because he has the VMAT calculator that he gave me. And it's like memorialized in my chart. The midwife charted it in there that I said that. And I was like, I did it. I cried to my midwife, and it's so focused on having this successful VBAC. And I did it. And everything was just like, everything like checked every box and went through the timeline I expected. It was great. And I said, this was an amazing experience. I want to come back and work with you guys. I didn't say this right at the birth, but, you know, at my 6-week appointment, as I start like settling in, and I'm like, I want to come back here and work. And they were like, okay, like, you know, they kind of suggested doing a doula training first. And I was like, all right, let's do it. So I did do a doula training at, my son was 2 months old. Which was a little crazy. It was out of town. My mom went with me. It was a little funny, but it was great. And I did take a couple clients, mostly like some friends and then family. And then I did have one that was actually unrelated, and that was awesome. And then the way my birth center does it, and there's a few different ways to train as a midwife in the United States. So there's like the nurse track, and then there's a CPM, a certified professional midwife. And you can do that 2 different ways. One, there's schools out there that do that. And then some states allow something called the PEP process, which basically is just on-the-job training, like a whole bunch of on-the-job training. And my birth center does that. And so they had kind of said, like, call us back when your son's a year old. They don't like to start new moms too soon, or they want to make sure that, you know, they have the time and attention they need to like dedicate to birth work, because it takes a lot. So they called me, the owner called me in, I'll never forget, December. He was born in June of 2022. So in December of 2022, she says, I have a student spot in January and I want to offer it to you. I was like, oh my gosh, what's happening? And so I did it. It was, at first, it was 3 on-call days a week. So I was like, okay, that's manageable. I made sure my husband was on board and my parents, because I was like, I think I'll probably need some backup. And I don't know if I can do it without you guys. And so they agreed. And I started in January of 2023. I worked very fast. I ended up becoming hired a full-time birth assistant in May, June of that year. And then I was on call 24/7. The way our birth center does, it's anywhere from 3 is a low month, and usually we're closer to like 5 to 7 a month, births a month. And then about right now we do 3 clinic days a month or a week as well. So I started coming to every birth and almost every clinic day very early on. So I was able to finish all those, like you have to have a certain amount of births, you have to have a certain amount of exams, like prenatal, postpartum, newborn exams, different situations, things like that, training. So I was able to complete that relatively quickly. It takes a minimum of 2 years before you can even think about submitting. And so I did that and I finished the 2-year mark in September of 2024. And then I just waited to submit my paperwork. They took my huge licensing exam in January of 2025 and passed. And then that gives me a national license. And then I have to submit to the state as well. So I have a national license and we are state licensed as well. And that was in, January, beginning of 2025. I knew this whole time that I wanted a third baby. Everyone knew. I said, fine, I'll wait until I'm done training at least. And this one, although we wanted a third baby, was a little less planned than the other two. So it was a little bit of a surprise when in March I got pregnant. You know, a month and a half after I licensed, I was like, well, I licensed, so that's all done now. I got pregnant, and of course, I was like, well, I'm going to have my baby here at the birth center. Like, that's, I work here. All my friends are here. That's what I'm going to do. The midwife I work with actually asked me, we don't do home births. We did back in the day, but we don't anymore because we're just a little bit too busy to do that. And it's hard to be in two places at once. And we don't have like such a large staff to be able to do that. But she had home births. And so she offered, she said, do you want to have a home birth? Like for you, we'll do that. And I was like, I hadn't really thought about it, but I was like, yeah. I had moved during this time, actually when I was 5 weeks pregnant, to the town that the birth center's in. So I was close to it and close to everyone here. So this whole time we're planning on a home birth. And I mean, it looked, pregnancy appointments looked very similar to last time, except for the fact that they were just with my friends. So it was a little funny. I felt very funny sitting on our client's side of the couch instead of the provider's side and hanging out and answering all the questions that I could, you know, recite in my sleep. And it felt a little different, but still very well cared for, still had got to make all my decisions. And again, mostly uncomplicated pregnancy besides working as a birth worker on call 24/7 and having, you know, 2 young kids. They're 3.5 and 5.5 when baby was born. Yeah. And it went great. I went to a chiropractor. And that's pretty much all the work I did. I had to meet with my best friend, the MFM doctor, again. And he wasn't even going to run the BVAC calculator, but we teased him about it. Because we were like, oh, you're not even going to run that? And he was like, why would I? He's like, I'll run it just for fun. And it was like 92% or something like that. And he said, he's like, it would be criminal to cut you open again. He's very, like I said, very forthright, which I appreciate as a provider. And working
with
him.
Do you think now working with him, he runs it less on people in general?
No, I think, because he has to. He has to for his, you know, egg hog and everything like that. But he is very supportive of home birth and stuff. He's just like, I have to present the risks. These are the risks. And if you know what the risks are and you choose, that's your choice. Awesome. But he's like, I have to present the risks. And that's what he told me when I told him. I was like, you told me my baby was going to die. And he was like, no, I'm just saying if something happened at a hospital, like the chances are. And he's like, I have to present that to you. And I was like, I understand. And I did. But at the time, I didn't understand.
While we're on this topic, can we talk about what does it look like from a midwife standpoint? How do you handle those emergencies? Like, what does like an emergency protocol look like for the clients that are at the birth center that maybe are experiencing signs of uterine rupture and things like that? Like safety standards, because I imagine that someone listening might be like, oh my gosh, they're saying that like I'm accepting the risk of all of these things when we know that out of hospital birth is a safe and reasonable option. So can you like tell us a little bit more about what that looks like?
Yeah, we have to have a very detailed like emergency transport plan. And the whole time we have to make sure that people are remaining low risk and healthy, to stay in midwifery care, which is why we consult with our MFM doctors over various different things and why our license and guidelines say you have to have a consult for this, you have to transfer for this. And it's pretty tight parameters. And so we do have our local hospital is basically across the street from the birth center. And we're lucky that our ambulance service hangs out. They like have a hangout spot. I'm not exactly sure where it is, but it's very close. They get to the birth center very fast when we call. And, you know, these emergencies, although they do happen, are truly pretty rare that we see those true emergencies. A lot of transports are for things like retained placenta. Though that's probably my most common, like emergency fetal heart tones is another one. And they're pretty quick. And we just have this guideline where we say, you know, this is what's going on. And we try to transfer with our client and get them to where they need to be ASAP. And the EMTs are pretty well known. Like, we've actually done some EMT training in the area with actually the next county over, but hopefully it spills into our county with these types of calls, because I think a lot of like EMTs and firefighters are like terrified. They're terrified of babies. They're terrified of a phone call they're going to get from somebody birthing. And so now that they've like trained with us, they're like, oh, if a midwife calls me, a true like licensed professional midwife or nurse midwife, then he's like, this isn't scary anymore. Like, they are like really knowledgeable in neonatal resuscitation and CPR and those types of things. We're the transport. Like, we're getting them from to the higher level of care. So yeah. Working on those relationships.
Like, pretty good relationships with like the providers that you transfer into for clients.
So, maybe
not as much.
We're working on it. We're really working on it. We've done a lot of like advocacy and like some of these, like I said, these trainings to kind of help with that. Like I said, we have those three hospitals. Actually, technically, we have four hospitals, three of one company and one of the other. One of them is closing. The one that I had my first daughter at is closing, the water birth. And that's the only one that allows water birth. So we're really sad about that. And then we have a large hospital with a higher level NICU. And that one actually, it serves as the only NICU for 200 miles surrounding us. So So they have they have hospitalists there. So we do try to transfer to that hospital. Usually we have a really good relationship with that hospital just because they're also used to receiving people that aren't their patients. Yeah. And that's kind of what they do, especially with these like smaller rural communities, you know, a couple hours away. Like, this is the only option.
That makes sense. Ask because I was a birth center transfer with my C-section. And I definitely experienced the bias of providers being like, oh, God, like, here's the unsafe lady that I was like, my baby's actually like, he's fine. He's just upside down.
He's fine. We do get that. We do get that. And we're trying not to. And I get, like I said, a lot of it's just fear or, you know, NICU nurses in particular see scary things. We do have a wide prevalence of free births in our area. And so like the confusion is like, oh, they're having the baby not in the hospital. Like, they don't have any provider with them. Sometimes that's the feeling we get. And we're like, no, actually. So.
Totally. That makes sense.
Taking a quick break from our episode to share this important stat with you. Did you know a 2025 retrospective cohort study published in the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology found that doula care was associated with about a 15.6 increase in VBAC rates compared to those without doula support? Lily and I love doulas, and we are doulas. The VBAC Link was founded by doulas Julie Frankham and Megan Heaton, who created a comprehensive VBAC course for doulas. It's fully self-paced, completely virtual, and when you complete it, you're added to the VBAC Link doula directory. You'll also earn 8 ICEA continuing education hours and become a VBAC certified doula. And if you're a parent looking for a VBAC Link certified doula, you can find one at thevbaclink.com/findadoula. All right, let's get back to the episode.
Cool. Yeah. Well, thank you. All right. Yeah. Well, back to your birth story.
Okay. So pregnant and working at work.
So he ran the calculator.
Oh, yes. And the calculator. And he said, you're good to go. And this was at 20 weeks. Sometimes we do have a 20-week anatomy scan. And then sometimes we do growth ultrasounds. But as long since I had that VBAC consult, because I had a consult since I'm VBACing on a hospital, I didn't have to have a growth ultrasound at this time. This is the first pregnancy I did not have a growth ultrasound, which will come in later. So I did that. Everything was great. We decided to do a surprise gender this time, which was fun. I had a boy and a girl already, so we were like, let's do it. And we moved into our new house, so getting all settled with that. This baby was due. My first two were born in May and June. This one was born in December, so it was a little different, like, time of being pregnant. It was a very little different experience. I have a really great team backing me up over the years. There's been a bit where it was just two of us, but now I have a senior midwife who's been there a long time, and then we have two students who, or at the time were students, but they were in their primary phase, so like catching babies, running appointments, things like that. So they were very like helpful and supportive as well, and able to pick up a lot of like my slack, I would say. I mean, I wouldn't say like I was slacking or anything, but you know, they were like, okay, sit down, like that, those types of things, which is really nice. And we take turns like catching babies. A lot of times our students do most of it as they get to that point. So I wasn't doing a lot of that at that point, except for a few like repeat clients or things like people that I like really formed a connection with. Yeah. And then we kind of just were playing it by ear of when I would be done working. And we decided, I kind of decided I was getting really tired and uncomfortable and tired of waking up at night. And so we kind of decided I'd work through my 37th week. The last baby I caught was 35 weeks pregnant, which wasn't necessarily the plan, but I had just like worked really, really hard with this client and it just felt right. And I was able to sit in a chair for the most of it next to the tub and then just caught the baby. So it worked out. And then I actually did go to a birth the day before my due date. I begged to go because she was a three-peat client for me. So this was her third baby with us. And I was like, I don't want to miss her baby. And I happened to look at our like online charting system and knew she was in labor. And it was during the day. It was like in the around dinner time. And I knew she birthed easy. And I was like, please. And they were like, okay, if you sit there and do nothing, then you can come. And I did. I literally sat in a rocker in her room and just was there for her. And it was really special. So that wasn't the plan either. But so I was still doing these things up until my due date. I was due December 23rd. And I was really upset about the idea of a Christmas baby. And I was like, I don't want that. I don't want that. But then you get closer and you're like, whatever, whatever the baby wants to come, it's fine. And I was feeling like larger, but not huge. Like, again, this kind of comes in later, but I was measuring on track. Everything looked great. I chose not to weight track. So we didn't really know that. We kind of had a baseline from the beginning and that was about it. But fundal height was measuring great. Baby looked good. Baby had a couple like episodes of tachycardia, so fast heart rate. We were able to get like throughout pregnancy, and we were able to like get down the fluids. Like these were the only like little things. And like looking back, I'm like, these may have been signs. But at the time I'm like, I'm just dehydrated. Like I'm working hard. Like baby's great. So Christmas, I was like, okay, Christmas came and went. And I was like, okay, I'm done. I'm done. So I texted my midwife and said, can I come in for a sweep? And I did on the 26th and did a whole bunch of like curb walking. Baby was hanging out high and it had been like that with my other two pregnancies. So I didn't really think anything of it. Is that the baby was high until labor started. First baby never really dropped because of positioning. Second baby dropped just fine. And so I was like, oh, maybe that's just what my body does. Didn't really think much about it. I wasn't too worried about it. I did a bunch of curb walking. I decided to do just like a dose of castor oil in like a shake. I didn't want to do the whole like protocol or really push things, but I was like, I want to give a little nudge. And if it doesn't work, then it doesn't work. And it worked. So I just took one dose of castor oil on the 26th. And contractions started within a few hours. I started kind of tracking them. And they started pretty close together, but really mild and short, which was a little different. So they were like 3 to 5 minutes apart, but like 20, 30 seconds and just pretty mild. And I was like, okay, great. And so we had just gone through this like thing of people having really fast labors and trying to figure out, like, when do we have them come into the birth center? Like, when's too soon versus too late? And so we were having these conversations. And so I was like, this is my third baby. I don't know if it's going to act like a second baby, as second babies usually come very quickly. And so I had everybody come over a little early on my part, but also they're my friends. So they came over at like 10 o'clock and I was 5 centimeters and I was like, great, we're going to hang out and things are going to go quick. It's going to be great. I ended up watching The Grinch just kind of like take my mind off of it in and out of the shower. So I had the two students, the midwife I work with, the owner of the birth center, who's a licensed midwife as well. She doesn't go to births anymore, really, but because she's my boss and my friend, then she came to mine. She didn't come till a little bit later. I had a doula, and I also had my best friend, who's a birth photographer, and then my mom was here. I had sent my kids off with my dad, and so I was like, I could really like settle into it, and things just seemed slower. I was like, okay. They always say third babies are the wild card. And there's also, I don't know if you guys have heard this, but also the saying out there, like, birth workers tend to have interesting, harder labors, or there's something that happens. I don't know. I kept hearing this. And I was like, no, it's not going to be like that. It's going to be great. It's going to be fine. And it was fine. And I kept, you know, as a provider, kept being in my head like, oh, where's baby at? Or asking things I would as a provider. And they kept telling me to stop. And I was like, oh, no, I need to know. It's fine. And it just took a while for things to like really pick up. She checked me at like 10 o'clock and I was a 5. I asked to be checked at like 2 a.m. So it'd been 4 hours and I was at a 6 and I was not expecting that. And especially with, I was having consistent contractions. They were starting to get more intense, but they still weren't where I thought they like should be. And at that point, I was a little bummed. I was like, what the heck? But after that check, things picked up really like quickly. And I was like, oh my gosh, here we go. And within an hour, I, you know, was vocalizing through contractions now, and I asked to be checked again just because I was like, wow, this is really intense. And I was like a 9. I was like, great, can you please break my water? I was like, I'm done. Please break my water. And she did. And there was so much fluid. And I was like, wow, that's a lot. I've only ever seen poly one time with someone's water broken, polyhydramnose. And it was startling how much fluid there was. And so we all wondered, we're like, this is a lot of fluid. I wonder if I had poly. And that's kind of the thought I had about it at the time. Like, whatever, it's broken, baby's good, everything's great. I get into the tub at that point, which was great for a little bit. And again, this is when they called the birth center owner over, because we're like, we're going to have a baby like so quick. It's 3 o'clock in the morning now-ish. And so she came over and there just wasn't a baby coming. So I got out of the tub. I tried different like hands and knees positions, different things like that. I was getting really tired at this point. So I think it was like maybe like 6 o'clock in the morning. They asked to give me an IV for some energy. And I was like, great, give it to me. So I had an IV. I got back in the tub and kind of just rested. Everyone was wiped at this point. So everyone kind of just took a nap all over my house. We have the sunroom off our bedroom and that's where the tub was. So my mom and my husband were there. There's a love seat in there and they were there dozing in between contractions. I napped in between contractions. And I just remember though being pretty frustrated. I was like, I should have had a baby right now. Something is different. I never said something is wrong, which I'm glad, but I was like, something is different. I'm comparing it to my last labor and I'm like, it wasn't like this. It wasn't like this. And they just kind of were, you know, all of the things is every birth is different. Every labor is different. Every baby is different. And I was like, I get that. But I'm like, I should have had a baby by now. And I'm just getting worn out and really tired. And I had a lot of intense back pain. which I didn't have before. We wondered about baby's position for a little bit, but I was like, I don't think that's it. And I'm trying to get out of my brain, but also at the same time, still kind of hanging out in there from the things I know and the labors I've seen. I think kind of at this point, after the IV and the nap, I did finally just like give up on thinking for myself on those things. But it took a while for them. I remember at one point I told Willa, the owner of the birth center, I said, I want to go to the hospital. I want an epidural. And she said, I don't remember exactly what she said, but she did say something along the lines of, you're going to have to tell me this 6 more times for us to have a serious conversation about this. And she, whatever she said, which again, I don't remember, but whatever she said really perked me up. And I was like, okay, you're right. You're right. Like, I'm not going. Although for the next few hours, every time I came in out of contractions, I was like, well, if I did transfer, it would take this long to get here, there, and it would take this long to check in. It would take this long to get fluids. It would take this long to get an epidural. Like, you know, but I never got to the point where I was like, we're going. Like, I was like, no, we're going to stay here and do this. But it did get to this point, and I don't really remember that. Again, last time was like this. And so I had a little bit more time to like sit in my thoughts this time. I had another midwife check me. The midwife that I actually wanted to manage my labor is one of our primary students. She's one of my friends from even before I had a baby. And so I was it was really special to have her manage my labor, but she did at one point ask the senior midwife to check to make sure, like, she's like, what am I feeling? Like, I want to make sure I'm not missing anything. And baby had started coming down a little bit, but was still higher than we would expect at this point. And she was like, I really want you to be in upright positions. And I was like, oh, that sounds horrible. I don't want to do that. And so I did. She wanted me to take a walk around the house. I think I made it from my bedroom to the dining room, which, I don't know, it's probably like 20 feet away. And I was like, I'm done. I'm going back. Sat on the toilet a lot. The first time I sat on the toilet, just didn't really do anything. Did hands and knees, lunges, just trying to get baby to come down.
And can we talk about that too?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, positioning can sometimes really sucks. And I think, like, as I remember with my first labor, getting really kind of mad at my doula, because in my head I was like, you're here to make me comfortable. Like, why are you having me do these things that are making it worse?
Yeah, I was kind of upset with my midwife. And I was like
worse is what we want.
I know. And I'm always the one telling people this. And I'm like, well, sometimes the most uncomfortable spot is where you need to be. And then I'm over here like, no, I don't want to. I did it begrudgingly, but I did all the things she asked. Oh, and this time I had my doula, bless her heart, pretty much the whole time had a massage gun on my back, which I had heard a couple people of using, but I hadn't used one in labor before. But it's like the only thing that really helped that like back pain. Like the hip squeezes just weren't strong enough. And it would die because it only held a charge for so long and we were using it constantly. And they tell me, like, they were like, your face when it would die, it was so sad. And I would use the TENS unit when it died and we had to charge it, but it wasn't the same. And I was like, oh, I want that massage gun back. And then some of those positions are like, when I got in the tub, I'm like, well, we can't use the massage gun now. What are we going to do?
Yeah, it really is a hard mental game. And I think, but something I think that people need to know, because I think so often we go into labor thinking like, I'm going to find like the most comfortable position. And as a doula, I struggle with that sometimes with my clients. I'm like, hey, I see you. I know that you're like super cozy. And like,
well, we got to do something.
I think that we should change something. So I do warn my clients in our prenatal meetings even that like, hey, in labor, I might suggest something and it might make things really, really spicy. And if you can just try to stay there for 3 contractions, like, let's make a deal. Can we stay there for 3 contractions and just see how it goes? Because sometimes like after 3, you settle in too,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's just like the change of pace that makes things worse for a second and then it can get better. But go you for like doing what they asked, even though
I know. And it's like, I knew that this why they were asking me, even in labor, I was like, I know, I have to do that. You're right. But I was definitely like, I don't want to do that. But we did that. And then around 11-ish in the morning now at this point, like exhausted. I went back to sit on the toilet, and I had like tried to check myself a few times, and I was like, I can't feel the head. Like, where is this baby? And I went back to the toilet, and finally, like, something felt different. And I went to check myself, and I was like, I don't even know what I'm feeling. And I do this for a living. I don't even know what I'm feeling. I was like, it doesn't feel like a baby head, but it doesn't feel like my tissue either. I'm like, what am I feeling? And the midwife, so the student midwife that I like wanted to do everything, she's like, I'm sitting on the toilet and she's in front of me. My husband's right next to us. Our bathroom is not very big. People in the hallway. And she's like, can you like stand up a little bit so I can kind of see what's going on? And I was like, no, I didn't say that. I didn't move. Everything was fine. I think it was ended up being like a head wrinkle, but it was so thick that I was like, what is that? It should be hard. But it was just funny moment. Like, I don't know what I'm feeling and this is what I do. Like, I should know, right? But finally, and I had been like kind of pushy for the last couple hours. We'd even tried some like practice pushing and like they could feel baby move, but it wasn't like really making progress. And I didn't want to be worn out. And so we kind of wanted to wait. And so finally I was like, oh my gosh, we're going to have a baby. like this baby's actually coming. And so I sat on the toilet for about 15 minutes and then I came back to our room and hands and knees. My last baby was on my back and I was like, I'd like to try something different. I mean, if my back works, so be it, but I'd like to do, you know, hands and knees. And so I was, and then finally, like, they could see baby's head and everyone started crying in the room. And I just think that the emotions of it being me and someone they like, I mean, we love all our clients, but like, it was just different for it being me and like everything I'd gone through and like this unexpected, like long labor. So that was pretty special. And everyone was like, okay, we're having a baby. Like, this is great. And baby does this really slow, like, descent. And I remember, like, you know, the ring of fire. And I was like, oh my gosh, I feel like this hurts so much worse than last time. I know we blocked some things out and maybe it felt just like this last time, but I was like, it feels different. Like, it feels more extreme. Baby was really hanging out there. I felt like I didn't have any more contractions at that point to push, but I at that also was like, we're done. Like, this baby's coming out. And so baby just kind of was really slow. And at one point they were like, let's try flipping you on your back and just kind of see if that gives baby a little bit more room with your legs up. And I was like, okay. So I do that. And baby's head comes out in McRoberts. So back, you know, with my legs up. But it was such a slow descent that everyone in the room, including myself, was like, that is a signal that there could be a shoulder dystocia. And I knew that in the back of my head and kind of expected I'd have to do some positioning. And sure enough, baby gave the telltale sign of turtling, which I couldn't feel on my end. I don't know. I feel like I should have, like, people should be able to feel it, that like pulling back in, but you can't. And so they asked me to flip again and then into a runner's lunge and back to McRoberts and suprapubic pressure. And at this time, like, I think everyone was a little bit more nervous than I was. I was like, whatever I have to do, everything's fine. Like, everything's great. Like, I'll do whatever. And I never was worried. And eventually she did get in there and grab baby's armpit and pull baby out as everything's going on. It was about 4 minutes. It was a substantial amount of time. And baby comes out and is not looking great. But again, I was never worried. I was like, we're trained. We're trained to deal with this. And I just wasn't like worried. Baby had some breasts with the bag and mask, some like simulation, and perked up very quickly. I remember I had a really short cord. And so baby was like on my belly instead of my chest. And I just remember being like, you're huge. Like, baby had like the chunky rolls on the hands and the arms and everything. But I couldn't really like tell. I was already expecting a 9 to 10 pound baby based off of my 8-10 C-section. And then my first VBAC was 9-1. So I was kind of already expecting 8 or 9 to 10 pounds anyway. And then I saw baby And I remember because I, while they're like trying to, you know, make sure my baby's breathing and everything, I had to find out what gender I was. That's how worried I was. So I did, I felt because I couldn't see or pull baby up. And I was like, it's a boy. And yeah, just really wasn't worried about what they were doing or anything like that. So we get everything cleaned up. I wanted the placenta to stay attached to baby so I could do the cute little picture with the heart of the cord and everything. And placenta took 25 to 30 minutes, not bad. Two of the, so my midwife and one of the students ended up having to go to the birth center for a potential other labor. So I was a little bit of a bummer, but they were there for all the important parts. And then as placenta's coming, I also start to have a hemorrhage. So clots come out with the placenta. And I'm over here like, it's fine. Just give me Pitocin. Like, I'm like telling them what to do back now that I've had a baby and not, you know, and everything going on. I'm like back in my midwife brain. And they're like, I know. So I got a shot of Pitocin and then placenta came out. It seemed to stop for a little bit. And then something what we call it a fountain. It really looks like a fountain of blood. Instead of like coming out, it's kind of like spraying out. And so that happened again. And again, I was like, yeah, it's fine. I know you got to give me another shot. It's great. Telling them what to do. And I was, never worried at this point. And I was really, considering the amount of blood loss, I was really well, like, with it. I just was, like, super happy to be done, as we all are, and to have my baby. And then I did have a tear, which I wasn't surprised after everything that had happened. And then when she's, like, trying to get ready to suture me, again, I start bleeding. So I kind of got, and then I got side effects. So I got everything, like, kind of thrown at me with that.
Can we talk about side attack postpartum versus side attack during like an induction? Because I think a lot of people might get hung up on like, wait, I thought you couldn't use side attack if you were a VBAC. So can you talk about
that? Is a good point. I've never thought of that. Yeah. So you're right. So side attack and like Cervidil as cervical ripeners for an induction are not indicated for VBACs. Increases the risk of rupture, but postpartum, it's actually an anti-hemorrhagic. And so it is given to you differently. So I like what we do is two orally in the cheek. And so you kind of let them dissolve and then two up your butt. And that's what enters your bloodstream the fastest. And so, yeah, a little totally different use at that point. But you're right. No side attack before baby comes out. And as midwives, we're not allowed to use Pitocin before baby comes out either. But it does the same. I mean, it clamps down the uterus, so helps with bleeding. And we also carry a couple other drugs as well, just like the hospital.
Yep. We love a midwife because you have all of the tools, right? And so thank you for dispelling. Like, I love that your story kind of has some of these like little nuggets in there of like, what does it look like to manage a hemorrhage and have a shoulder dystocia at home? And with a qualified team, you're in really great hands.
Yeah.
Not being worried.
I really wasn't. And I joke around that we had, you know, all the things. They had kind of brought a lot of stuff and set it up ahead of time here. And I joke around that we used everything that they brought except the oxygen. I was like, we didn't need it. But yeah, we carry oxygen and all the drugs we would to manage hemorrhage, like the hospital. And we have bag and masks for baby and mom. And we're all trained in neonatal resuscitation. So I guess that's why I was never worried about it. Baby's Apgar was a 3. He wasn't breathing. His heart rate was really low. His tone was not good. His color was not good. But with just a few breaths of air and some stimulation, he perked up so quick. And his 5-minute Apgar was a 10. And so all he needed was some air, which is really awesome. Yeah. And so I get cleaned up. I get sutured, which last time I remember when I was being sutured, it just felt like my legs were up for so long. I was so upset. I was like, this is taking forever. And this time I was just like chit-chatting. Like I said, it was like hanging out with my friends besides the really hard part in between. And then I get like, you know, situated in bed and we're going to do the newborn exam. So we always do that after an hour or two after baby's born at the foot of the bed. And that's where we're going to measure and weigh them and all that fun stuff. And I guess I was like, okay, this baby's 10-8. Like, I know this is a chunky baby, And we use fish scales, which is fun. So we have this picture of baby, and my husband did it with her, weighing him in this fish scale. And it maxes out at 12 pounds. And so there's a picture of it all the way at the end. And it's like right below. So 11, 14. And I was like, 10, 8, 10, 8. And she's over here. And she's like, oh, Katie, no. And I was like, what? And there's a picture of me on the other side of the bed going, like, just shocked. I was shocked. Everyone was shocked. Like I said, we have some tools without ultrasound to kind of like tell how big a baby is. I hadn't had a girl to ultrasound this time. I had expected a larger baby, but not this. Like, this was just so unexpected. I had measured my fundal height was about a week ahead, which, again, with the like what we expected, that was on track. And so we were just shocked. We were shocked. And it is our birth center record. Our birth center has been in business since 2015. It's actually been in business longer, but the current owner has owned it since 2015. And this is the biggest baby ever born there. The previous year, I know. The previous year, we had a baby born that was 11-10. And at that point, we were like, wow, like that's it. That's the record. Yeah. I didn't want to beat that record, but of course I did. And I was just like, wow. He is big. He had no sugar issues, which a lot of these larger babies do have sugar issues. I had not tested for gestational diabetes with the Glucola. We'll never know for sure if it was undiagnosed gestational diabetes or not. I hadn't had any signs in pregnancy. Looking back, like I said, there's a few things that I'm like, maybe. But at the time, there was always like some other reason for it. I had done some like glucometer blood sugar checks. I hadn't done the log, but I had checked like randomly throughout pregnancy and things like that. So we'll never know for sure, but there's a possibility that's what it was from. But he didn't have any sugar issues, which I would have expected from such a large baby. And yeah, he kept gaining weight. Now he's 2 months old, and we'll know for sure, but at his 6 week checkup, he was 15 pounds, 13 ounces. So just a big boy. Yeah.
I don't know that my 15-month-old weighs 15 pounds.
I know. I was like, my other two were like 4 or 5 months old before this happened. This is crazy. No newborn diapers. No newborn clothes. Mm-mm. Barely in size ones.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh,
and gosh.
I just still processing a couple months later of how big that baby was and like what happened in labor. I definitely feel, I mean, like, yeah, wow, I did that. That's amazing. And everyone that hears like how big the baby was, they're like, what? You had that baby at home naturally without an epidural? Like, it's crazy. And thinking back, you know, that whole conversation about transferring to the hospital, I was like, if I had transferred to the hospital and gotten an epidural, I don't think that baby would have been born vaginally. Because I couldn't move. I wouldn't have been able to get into the positions I needed to get the baby out. And so I'm thankful.
Exactly. I love about your story so much is like, as we're talking about different reasons for cesareans, like you hit on so many in hospitals or other locations or just other providers where a team could be really jumping to, okay, there's issues, there's this, there's that, there's this, we have to do a growth ultrasound, we have to this and that, or if you're restricted to the bed, if you can't move. So your story really hits on what to do if you suspect a big baby, or how crucial movement is, how crucial it is to have a team that is capable of handling those things and doesn't freak out. And how calm you were because you trusted your team, and just how powerful education is in knowing, like, yes, this is possible. Yes, if this happens, there are things we can do to navigate it. So glad to have you here. Oh,
there's like so many people that would have gotten a growth ultrasound and then just been told you can't even attempt to be back.
I know. And like, I'm like, when, like, if I had one, what would that baby have measured? It's kind of this catch 22. Is like, ignorance is bliss, but also if I had that information, would I have made a different decision, or something, I've done something else in my care. So again, I can't go back, but it is kind of like, yeah, interesting that I didn't do that this time. And I do think there was the component of ignorance is bliss, like especially with some of the anxiety I was having going in. I mean, I watched woman after woman have unmedicated labors and births for my entire pregnancy. And so sometimes I was like, that's hard. I don't know if I want to do that again. And so having some of that anxiety, I think if I had some of that other knowledge beforehand, that wouldn't have helped that. But yeah. And it was just a really big moment of like surrender, especially when I was like, this is different. Something's different. And I'm so glad like there was an immediate answer of what was different versus like, I'll never know. I'll never know. I'm like, well, that baby was huge. Like, of course, like X, Y, and Z happened. But, you know, in the moment, I was like, what is going on?
Yes. Oh, my gosh. Well, actually, it's also perfect that you are here today. And I want to get your insight as a midwife. And we hear that you had midwives attending your births out of hospital. But there was an article that our founder just sent us this weekend about a hospital changing its policies from midwives being able to attend high risk, aka what they labeled as VBAC. And that does happen, whether it's like a VBAC ban in general. You're talking about also how hospitals in your area don't even do VBAC. And just tell us some of your thoughts and feelings on midwives attending VBAC in general, whether it's out of hospital, in hospital.
Well, and I think the research is out there that there's a really high success rate of midwives attending VBACs versus OBs. And whether that means in-hospital midwife or an out-of-hospital midwife. But there are only some states that allow out-of-hospital VBACs, actually. Luckily, I live in Oregon, and that is one of them where we have a pretty broad scope of what we can attend. And I knew before I was even a midwife that that was my chance for a VBAC. And so to take that away is just really disheartening. We've had some struggles in Oregon of them trying to take that away from us as well. Midwives in Oregon can also attend breech births and twins. So there's been some, discussion like of taking that away. And we, of course, don't want that because the success rate and the safety, the data shows for itself of how high it is. We get a lot of VBACs. I don't say we have very many primary VBACs in our clientele because I think a lot of people think like, I need to be close to a hospital because I had a C-section before. But once they have a hospital VBAC, we get a lot of VBAC clients as well coming to see us.
But your birth center does take primary VBAC.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So if you're in Oregon, look up Katie. Look up her birth center. Well, thank you so much. And is there any other advice that you have for our community, for women looking for a VBAC or from the perspective of a midwife?
Just, I think we kind of touched on it, is like your team is important, is so important for your like mental health, because there's also like there's such a mental component to labor, whether you're unmedicated or not. And so having that like safety that I felt and like that friendship for me, it was super special to have that. And I just think it gave another layer of like, I can do this. And who's to say if I didn't have these people telling me over and over again that I could do this, like would I have been like jump ship and been like, we're going to the hospital? Maybe. So yeah, it was really, really important to just who your team is. And I know that not everyone can have that special provider, but then, you know, filling your team, the rest of your team, with someone else that you can count on.
Perfect. That's amazing. Well, I personally am incredibly inspired by you having, you said your oldest is 5.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. Working as a midwife with 2 little ones, I can't even begin to imagine how chaotic that all is to juggle. And you talked about it like it was easy, although we know that it's not, but you make it look easy. And your community is just so fortunate to have you. So thank you for the work that you do. It's definitely hard work. We know as birth workers that it takes a lot. It takes a lot in all the ways and a lot of sacrifice. So thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, guys. It's been fun to share my story today.
Would you like to be a guest on the podcast? Head over to thevbacklink.com/share to submit your story. For information on all things VBAC, including online and in-person VBAC classes, the VBAC blog, the worldwide database for VBAC doulas, and more, head over to thevbaclink.com. Congratulations on starting your journey of learning and discovery with the VBAC Link.
Thank you so much for tuning into today's episode and for being a part of our community. One of my favorite parts of the VBAC Link is the community itself. When I was pregnant and planning for a VBA 2C, the VBAC Link community group on Facebook truly became a virtual village for me. It's where I could see real VBAC stories, ask questions without judgment, and get encouragement from people who genuinely understood what I was preparing for. If you are planning a VBAC and want support as you get ready, head over to Facebook and search the VBAC Link community, because women of strength become even stronger together.